Support for this program is brought to you by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
From the studios of KUOM Radio K at the University of Minnesota, this is Culture Cube, the arts show that rocks. This week on Culture Q, one-hit wonders. Welcome to Culture Q. I'm your host, Noel Clark. During the winter break slump, we here at Culture Q like to dive through the archives for a classic episode every now and then. This week, we decided to bring you six pieces from our very own one-hit wonders, reporters who spent only a brief, shining moment with Culture Q before moving on to, well, somewhere. Our first story tonight comes from reporter Tony Wagner, who left us to write for the university's newspaper, The Daily. Tony reported on the winter wonderland known as the Holodazzle Parade in December of 2010.
This is Nicollet Mall in mid-November. Passing cars, shuffling feet, and the ever-present Salvation Army bell. However, when the holiday season comes around, this street is transformed into a festival of lights and music with the Target Holodazzle Parade. In its 19th year, the parade boasts 15 floats, over 350,000 lights, and over 300 costume characters, all of which light up Nicollet nightly in December. To learn more about Holodazzle, I spoke with Leah Wong, the Vice President of Events Marketing at the Minneapolis Downtown Council.
My name is Tony Wagner. I'm here to see Leah Wong.
The Minneapolis Downtown Council puts on the parade in conjunction with Target.
Target Holodazzle has happened in Minneapolis for 19 years. It is a parade of lights. It is often referred to or used in conjunction with the Disney Parade of Lights. It's a parade of floats that goes down Nicollet Mall that brings kind of holiday joy to many throughout the state of Minnesota.
Holodazzle even attracts people from out of state.
Well, we're from Bloomer, Wisconsin, so we drove up and my grandkids love to see it.
The parade also supports a good cause, thanks to the Minneapolis Downtown Council's partnership with Ameriprise Financial.
Thank you. We've partnered with them for 14 years on the Ameriprise Financial Food and Cash Drive. And the Food and Cash Drive benefits the Emergency Food Shelf Network, and Ameriprise Financial matches up to $20,000 of all food and cash donations that we collect along the parade route.
The parade also boasts some great musical acts, including choirs and marching bands. Tonight, December 11th, our very own University of Minnesota marching band will be performing. By the way, what you're hearing now is a very talented and really, really nice street performer that I talked to before the show.
I stopped messing around when the parade comes through and just kind of enjoy it. I want to see what the band do. That's my favorite.
The parade has 15 floats, all of which are based on classic fairy tales.
Do you guys have a favorite float in the parade?
The Target dog one.
The float she's referring to is actually the Pinocchio float, which leads the fairy tales. Pinocchio is soon followed by Hansel and Gretel. A circus train, complete with clowns and children dressed as animals. The Princess and the Pea. Peter Pan, and many, many more. But even with all of these great floats, the audience favorite is clear.
Santa Claus.
Santa.
My favorite part was Santa.
Santa Claus.
I love Santa.
Santa's your favorite?
Probably the most beloved float of the whole parade is Santa. He rides his sleigh down Nicollet Mall, and that's always a great way to end the parade.
If you haven't been to the parade yet, there are 6 more chances to go. There's tonight's performance with the University of Minnesota Marching Band, but there are also performances on the 12th and the 16th through the 19th. So grab some friends, head downtown, and enjoy the sights, sounds, and holiday spirit of this Minneapolis tradition.
Are you guys excited for the parade?
Yeah.
For Culture Q, I'm Tony Wagner.
Yo, VIP. Let's kick it. And listen, Ice is back with my brand new invention. Something grabs a hold of me tightly, flow like a harpoon daily and nightly.
Reporter Jessie Lehman was a busy student, yet she was able to take time out of the pursuit of her graduate degree to file this piece in November of 2011 about a puppet style play based on none other than Karl Marx.
Anything less than the best is a felony. Love it or leave it. You better gain weight. You better hit bulls out of kid. Don't play. If there was a problem, yo, I'll solve it. Check out the hook while my DJ revolves it.
The proletarians have nothing to lose but their chains.
Karl Marx is back, reincarnated as a 2-foot-tall puppet made of wood and felt. He and a contingent of other economic and political figures have taken up residence at the Walker Art Museum in Minneapolis. I'm going to break this down for you. Baby Marx is an art show about a sitcom, also called Baby Marx. A sitcom populated by puppets. A puppet television show starring Karl Marx, the famous founder of communism, and Adam Smith, the father of free market capitalism, who are joined by the likes of Lenin, Stalin, and Chairman Mao.
This is capitalism-fueled capitalism. Nobody even thinks about the fact that there was factory workers. They just go, oh, Andy Warhol, some guy.
You can picture it. Marx with his beard, gray felt suit. Adam Smith, white curly wig, big nose. Ridiculous accents on the both. It's pretty funny.
So one highlight of this meal, this cookie. It's like a little cherry on top of a crap sundae.
But the puppets and their humor serve a purpose, a way to talk about issues that are very much present in America today.
There is a very obvious social and political commentary in choosing this subject.
This is Janaki Ranpura. She's a Minneapolis artist and puppeteer who works on Baby Marx.
From my perspective, I'm glad to use puppets to talk about things that matter in the world today.
On the set of Baby Marx, Ranpura is puppeteer extraordinaire. She operates the puppets while doing their voices and improvising the script.
So I'm kind of the capitalist in the game. I've played Adam Smith and, I played Mao, and actually I did play Lenin. Milton Friedman, I think, I whirled his eyes around.
Ranpura also knows a lot about the theory behind puppetry.
Puppets have been very traditionally a form of political commentary, the sort of jester in the room that's able to say things that real people would get in trouble for saying. And we don't live in a repressed, censored society very much, so we don't necessarily have to use puppets, but they are drawing on that vein of commentary.
The workers, they're alienated from their jobs. They're just standing around, being bored, doing the same thing every day.
Their limited expression is hilarious as they're trying to struggle with, like, really big, epic themes.
As Ranpura explains it, Baby Marx is about more than just humor. Even the conditions of its realization are rooted in the current moment. Reyes' idea didn't receive support until the 2008 economic crisis prompted questions about the twin failures of communism and free market capitalism. At this juncture, Reyes was able to secure funding for Baby Marx, first in Japan and now the U.S. In Minneapolis, because of both the show's contemporary significance and a host of efforts by the curators, the set has become a center of debate, not just between puppets, but for the public as well.
I'm Ben Ansel. I'm an assistant professor of political science here at the University of Minnesota.
Dr. Ansel facilitated a town hall-style debate at the exhibit in August.
And academic debates I'm used to, but I think what none of us were used to is doing this within the context of an art gallery with a series of puppets staring at us as we did this. And in being forced to talk about these people that we normally talk about in a very jargon-filled way, but to try and relate that to what's going on today.
As it turns out, Baby Marx was only to become more relevant during its run at the Walker. About a month into its tenure, protesters in the Occupy Wall Street movement took to the streets, demanding essentially a redistribution of wealth. The conversations were about to get even more lively.
It seemed to us in August that this was timely and important, but somehow was missing from the popular debate. Now there are protests about the market and about how capitalism worked.
But it's not just what the protests are about. It's the fact that they are debates that speaks to the heart of Baby Marx.
It's a phenomenon. It's a phenomenon of social interaction. And there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, there's a huge amount to be said for that, that people get together and they don't need to know what they have to say before they figure it out. They get together in order to figure it out.
There are obviously still a lot of questions on the table. But for now, let's just ask one. What would Marx think?
I think he'd object strongly to being commoditized as a puppet.
The Baby Marx show will be at the Walker until November 27th. You can buy the Communist Manifesto in the gift shop for $5.95. For Culture Q, I'm Jessica Lehman.
Yo, listen up, here's the story about a little guy that lives in a blue world, and all day and all night and everything he sees.
The world of social media continues to offer new opportunities for people to make fools of themselves. So we wanted to see if Andrea Trichler's question of the week from October 2011 still rings true today. Andrea asked, "What's the most embarrassing thing you've seen on Facebook?"
I'm rude.
On Facebook, probably just a picture of somebody in a, like, lying in a pile of their own puke. Like a pile, not even a liquid one. There's chunks in there.
Oh, just party pictures so far. They're just bad. Like, people all trashed up.
Probably the naked photo of my brother wearing a Jingle Bell thong.
The Facebook side column, basically allowing you to be on Facebook while you're on Facebook. It's pretty embarrassing.
Probably someone asking about urinary problems.
I'm not on Facebook, so I don't know.
It's really when you see your, like, people that you know making some, like, big statement about how bad their life is, and then someone comments on it and they're just like, "Shut up, you don't have it that bad." And just like, you just feel really bad for that person, but, you know, still pretty funny. So
the most embarrassing thing I've seen on Facebook is when people take really embarrassing photos of each other, and sometimes it's like, I don't know, someone might be in the bathroom in the background when they don't expect it.
Those gross, like, mushy conversations between people who just started dating. They're like, "Oh, I love you, I love you, I love you more."
The friend report cards. I don't know, like, a lot about them. All I've seen is that you can rate your friends and, like, give them grades on, like, how cool they are. I'm not really sure, but they are pretty awful.
Some people are a little bit too vocal about their political beliefs, or sometimes they don't understand that it's a public forum.
I mean, I guess, like, pictures of girls peeing in, like, a field around the U. It wasn't even really a field. It was just sort of a little grassy area.
In 2013 will hopefully see the launch of the newly built Central Corridor Light Rail Transit System, intended to connect Minneapolis with St. Paul. In honor of this momentous achievement, we give you this report from Sean Nepple, who left us not just for another program, but another school. Sean filed this piece in the fall of 2011, in which he investigates the rash of cell phone thefts that occurred on and around our LRT trains.
Safe on the light rail.
Pretty safe. Same thing. Everyone's friendly. They do what you gotta do.
I love it. I feel real safe.
Kind of depends on the time of day. Like at night, I would not want to ride the light rail alone.
Depends what time it is.
During the daytime, it's okay.
I feel safer on the train than on the bus.
You know, I'm from Chicago, and you know, if I had to compare it to Chicago, I guess I would have to say I feel safe.
From 1 to 10, I'd say probably about a 6.
I'd say fairly safe.
I mean, it also depends what stop it is.
I feel safe on all the stops.
Franklin is okay. Airport, mall, those are pretty safe, but downtown, not really.
In the month of October, there have been a reported 19 robberies on the Hiawatha Light Rail line between the Metrodome and 46th Street Station. As two local students from Augsburg, Jeff Cornell and DJ Warrington, found out, the thieves are after cell phones.
I was getting on the 38th Street light rail station, and I got a text, so I pulled out my phone, and someone walking by hit it out of my hand, grabbed it off the ground, and ran.
Jeff's iPhone could easily have sold for $100 online, and with the new iPhone 4S selling for as much as $700 on sites like eBay and Craigslist, it's easy to see why the thieves are targeting smartphones. Even as phones become more and more secure, it's still easy for thieves to remove the SIM card and clear the phone to pass it off as their own. In a recent interview, Andy Hells of Don't Ditch It, Fix It in Edina told Bill Keller of Fox News, "All it takes is a little pin in the right hole and it just pops right out. They can clear all the information off the phone and make it their own, just like it came out of the box." As DJ found out, some of the thieves are willing to take whatever they can get.
After they took my buddy's phone, I started to like run after the guy down about a block or so. He was gone, and so I turned around to head back, and then as I was heading back, his friends were coming up that way, and they randomly asked if I had anything in my backpack. Told them I didn't, just kept walking. Then out of nowhere, they sort of just ran up and attacked me. I got a bloody nose, scraped up my knee a bit, ran back to the light rail and got on. And
DJ's experience is one of the rare cases where the thieves have actually assaulted someone. Most of the time, the thefts are quick snatch and runs, often with the thieves taking the phones and exiting the trains as the doors are closing. Jeff has some ideas on how to keep your phone and your information safe.
Don't take your phone out on the station or even on the train, because if you take it out on the train, people will see it and get interested and maybe like get off on the same station and same thing will happen. They have a lot of warnings like,
"Be aware that thieves are stealing cell phones and mobile devices from train customers."
This is just one of several new messages that have been playing at the stations throughout the month. The Metro Department has even added written warnings at the entrances and exits of most stations. Statistically, someone's chance of being robbed are around 1 in 50,000. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't pay attention next time you're on the light rail, because after all,
it's probably not as important as losing your phone.
Here with Culture Q, I'm Sean Nepp.
Spend any time on a large college campus, you're bound to run into people you know. Personally, I've bumped into this next reporter, Saoirse McMahon, several times over the course of my journalism studies. I still hold out hope that one day she will come to us with a sophomore follow-up to her March 2012 story on the speed competitions of Rubik's Cube Masters.
You hear that? That's the sound of a Rubik's Cube. And different cubers have their own tastes in how their cube should please the ear.
I guess fast and clicky would be like my favorite.
This one is like smooth and kind of slow.
Okay.
So that's how I describe mine.
Only a smooth one, and I guess it has a scratchy sound too.
So generally a smooth cube. If it's like crispy and like really fast, it kind of irritates my hands, I guess.
So what is this cubing they speak of? And how did they get to know cubes so well that they form such exquisite tastes in them?
I thought it was crazy. I never thought I'd be able to do it before. The most I could ever do was a side, and then I'd start working on more, but I'd just mess up what I had done, so.
That's Rob Northrup. He's a new cuber who started a year ago and hasn't been able to put it down ever since.
A friend of mine knew how to solve a cube about a year ago, and he taught me. And then about 4 months ago, I think, or 5 months, probably more than that, actually, I saw it sitting on the bookshelf, and I got bored, so I decided to pick it up and see how fast I can do it. And I just looked on YouTube for more tips and saw all this cubing stuff. So that's
Rob's not the only one. The rapidly growing cubing community has others stepping up to the challenge.
Yeah, the internet is definitely probably the biggest part for speed cubing. That's like where all contact done is, and YouTube plays a big part with people posting videos of their solving, and that helps teach people other things what they need to learn. So the internet's definitely the biggest thing for the speed solving community.
Some, like Chris Olson, are so involved that they attend official cubing competitions.
I solved my first cube about almost three and a half years ago, and I've been serious since about the start of that.
Albert Yu says he's a little newer to cubing.
I solved my first cube 5.5 years ago, but I only got serious in speed cubing about a year ago. And I've only been in one competition, which was last November.
Albert Yu, a student here at the U of M, is talking about the fittingly named Cubetra competition that takes place here in our very own state every year at First Evangelical Church in Minneapolis.
For me, what I excel in the most is definitely 2x2. I've been trying to break the world record the past few competitions. I'm fourth in the world right now and second in the U.S., so I'm definitely, that's the event I'm definitely best at. And then for 3x3, I'm 110th in the world and 18th in the U.S.
Chris won fourth in the world? Never mind being able to solve a cube. People are using the internet to learn speed solving and compete with some of the fastest people in the world.
But they have like a speed solving forum where a lot of people around the whole world can communicate about cubing. And then there's also like smaller Facebook groups online that you can be a part of.
I get faster.
Even though he's just started, Rob solves cubes every day, and sometimes he gets strange reactions from people.
People talking about trying to place bets on it. I've had somebody come up to me and say, you know, hey, I bet we could, you know, scam a buddy of mine out of some money. You know, we could bet that you can't do it, and then you do it, and you could get yourself some easy cash. So there's lots of interesting things like that. It's a conversation starter, definitely.
Okay, so cubing sounds fun, but what makes people keep doing it?
Well, for me, it's definitely like a stress reliever from school, because college can be pretty stressful at times. And if you solve a cube for like a set amount of time and totally just take your mind off of other things, it's really therapeutic in a sense, I guess.
I don't know, it keeps me thinking. As long as I'm thinking about the cube, I don't have to think about anything else. So if I've got nothing to do, rather than thinking about nothing, I can just pick up a cube and solve it.
And for those of you with a competitive streak, cubing is a type of sport for Chris.
Like, I don't ever want to put it down. It's just kind of fun to do, like a hobby. And I practice it like a sport, so there's motivation for me to keep going. And with people who can't solve it, they generally just get frustrated because they can't do it. So when you can do it, there's some sense of motivation to keep going.
Speed solving competitions aren't the only way to cube. Puzzles come in infinite shapes and forms, some that you can barely pronounce.
your dodecahedrons, like the megaminxes, the gigaminxes, the next size up, and the teraminx, and the pentaminx, and then there's the pyraminx, which is a pyramid shape. I have one of those too, and there's tons of different ones, so I really don't know how many there is, actually. There's just that many.
As a newbie cuber, Rob finds a sense of personal satisfaction in solving different kinds of puzzles.
First figured out how to solve a 3x3. I never thought that I'd be solving like the 5x5 or the 6x6, which are the bigger sized ones, and it just kind of blew my mind seeing those cubes. And when I first got into trying to speed cubing, I never really wanted to pick them up because they looked too complicated. And the more I saw videos on it, the more I wanted one. And
even one of the top three champions in the world says that cubing could be for anybody.
And I guess for whoever's listening, if you haven't tried it yet, definitely give it a shot. Like, just look something up online. I'm sure if you have a cube and you sit with it for a little while, I think you'll be able to figure out it's not as hard as people think it is. And that's something people kind of just need to get in their head. It's not very hard.
So for those of you who don't think you have the skills for cubing, even the pros say it's really just a matter of knowing where to find them. For Culture Q, this is Saoirse McMahon.
Well, that's our show. Reporters for this show were Jesse Lehman, Saoirse McMahon, Sean Nepple, Andrea Trichler, and Tony Wagner. Producers for Culture Q are Mitchell Skinner, Markita Foranoff, and Amy Friedman. Our culture coach is Sarah Lemanchek, and your host and managing editor is Noel Clark. You can find archives of our show on RadioK.org, and as always, we'll see you next week. Baila tu cuerpo, alegría, Macarena, que tu cuerpo pa dar la alegría y cosa buena. Baila tu cuerpo, alegría, Macarena. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.